Chapter 16. Present Day. After I got back from meeting with Devin, Ryan and I spent the evening stuffing ourselves on takeout food, binging Netflix, and trying to forget about how horrible the day was. The calls and texts from Ryan's friends throughout the day became so incessant that he ended up powering off his phone, which is something he rarely does. Neither of us got much sleep, so this Monday morning, it seems especially hard to get up and moving. Even though Ryan is taking the next several days off, he's still got a full day, since he offered to help with the planning of James's funeral. While I probably could have taken the day off as well, I don't want to be available to visit the Bernards again, nor do I want to be forced to devise a way to disappear around lunch to meet back up with Devin. I'm in the kitchen filling up a travel mug of coffee for each of us when Ryan starts down the stairs.
I'm heading to the Bernards first with a few of the guys, he says. Mrs. Bernard wants us to help her contact his work and let them know what happened. Then we're headed to the funeral home.
Yeah, I don't envy you today. I hand him his coffee and start packing my bag for the day. Oh, shoot, I left my phone on the charger upstairs. By the time I'm heading back down, Ryan is waiting by the door with his bag slung over his shoulder, his coffee mug in one hand and his keys in the other.
I shouldn't be too late tonight.
I grab my stuff from the chair. Me either. Call me when you're headed home and I'll duck out early, I say, then follow him to the garage. Just before I reach the door of my 4Runner, Ryan pulls me in close and kisses me gently.
I'm dreading today, he says quietly. Is it terrible that I don't want to go over there?
I run a hand down the side of his face, then wrap my arm around his neck, holding him close to me. He buries his face into the side of my neck. I'm so sorry, I whisper in his ear. I can feel my phone buzzing in my purse, but I don't let go of Ryan until he's ready. I'm not sure how long we stand there holding each other, but he finally pulls away, giving me one last kiss before he lets me go and moves to his car. I'm getting in my car as he climbs into his. As the garage door opens, he nods for me to back out first. I start inching out of the garage, since it's a tight squeeze, watching my passenger side mirror to make sure I'm not going to scrape the door of his car. As soon as I'm clear, I pull out my phone to give it a quick glance, since I rarely get notifications of any kind. It's a text from an unknown number, and my heart starts racing. I'm sure Ryan is wondering why I've stopped halfway down the driveway. I open the text. Unknown number, 911. Shit, that's my warning from Devin to get the hell out of here. I look up to find Ryan is stepping out of his car, his attention drawn to the street behind me. I check my rearview mirror, afraid of what I will see there. Three police cars have pulled up behind me, blocking us both in. It only takes a few seconds to realize there's no getting past them. It also occurs to me that had I not lingered with Ryan in the garage, I would have seen Devin's text as soon as I received it. Those few minutes may have cost me a clean getaway. Ryan is out of his car and moving to my door, attempting to open it, but the car is locked since I'm still in reverse. I do a quick mental inventory as to what is in this car that could possibly get me in trouble, but know that there's nothing. He knocks on the window.
Evie, open up.
His eyes track the approaching officers. With slow and deliberate movements, I put the car in park and cut the engine. The second Ryan hears the lock disengage, he opens my door and pulls me out. His face is wiped free of expression. Even though I didn't see him while he was talking to that rogue employee, I imagine this is what his face looked like then. Does he think they are here for him because they have discovered his activities in East Texas? I do appreciate the sentiment when he steps between me and the cops, but the text from Devin tells me they are here for me, and he can't save me from what's about to happen.
Don't worry, he whispers. I'll handle this.
He does think they are here for him. The same officer, Deputy Bullock from the Bernard's house, is leading the way up the driveway, his eyes probably twinkling behind the mirrored shades.
Ms. Porter,
he says as his hands rest on the low-slung gun belt around his waist.
I'm going to need you to come to the station with me to answer a few questions.
Ryan's hands are on his hips, blocking me completely from the police.
What is this about?
Deputy Bullock looks around Ryan to me.
There is a material witness warrant for you from Atlanta PD in connection with the death of Amy Holder.
I see two of the other officers moving in closer, and I don't want this to get any uglier than it has to. The Rogers, Ryan's next-door neighbors, have returned from their walk and are watching this unfold, as are several other people across the street. A few cars have stopped down the block. This quiet, tree-lined street has never seen such excitement. I put a hand on Ryan's shoulder, which causes him to turn toward me. I don't speak, but I nod, letting him know it's okay for them to take me with them. He stares at me a second or two, trying to read me so he can understand what's happening. The officers are gentle with me as they lead me to the closest patrol car. Thankfully, no one makes a move toward my car, so I'm hopeful it will still be here when I get out. Amy Holder was the mark for my last job, the one I didn't complete to Mr. Smith's satisfaction. But my alias for this job, Evelyn Porter, should have been a clean identity and should not be connected in any way to Amy Holder or her death. The fact that they are bringing me in for questioning about her death lets me know I've been compromised, and this somehow plays into the next step of whatever Mr. Smith has in store for me. It takes more focus than you can imagine to sit absolutely still. I have not tapped my foot or fidgeted in my seat or looked anywhere other than the light gray wall that is right in front of me. My breathing remains easy, inhaling through my nose and exhaling between my barely parted lips. My eyes blink in an easy rhythm, not too fast, not too slow. I know they're watching me through the mirrored wall to my left, but I refuse to give them so much as a twitch of my pinky finger, because I can't forget what Devin said the first time I met him in real life.
You can tell a lot about a person by the way they act when they are left waiting too long.
There was a big production of bringing me into the interrogation room and sitting me down at this table. Uniformed officers and plainclothes detectives streamed in and out, each wanting to have their part in this. I was offered something to drink. I was asked if I needed to use the restroom. I was asked question after question, all of which I answered with the absolute bare minimum response. The last question asked was by me. I asked for a lawyer. I requested Rachel Murray, although I'm sure Ryan has already called her himself. Sometime later, Rachel arrives and sits down across from me. I'm quiet while she openly studies me. I wasn't sure what to expect from her, delight in my detainment, or fear of sitting across the table from someone who may or may not be involved with a murder, or confusion as to why I requested her. But I don't get any of those. Her face is as blank as mine, and I'm happy with the route I've decided to take. She's going to make me speak first, which I respect. Will you represent me? I ask. I absolutely refuse to say anything to her that won't be protected by attorney-client privilege. Yes, she answers, then pulls a document out of the bag sitting by her feet. I figured you wouldn't talk to me without this. It's a standard agreement stating we are moving into a professional relationship in which Rachel is now my attorney of record. I sign at the bottom, then watch as she scratches her name below mine. I'm assuming you're good for the bill I will send you, she asks. I nod. Of course. She stuffs the document back in her bag and then moves to the door. Opening it slightly, she says, I'm the attorney of record for Miss Porter, so cut the mics and video feed to the room. The door shuts, then she moves to the window to lower a set of blinds. Now I have to trust this system and hope no one is about to hear what I'm about to tell her. This little bit of privacy has me shifting in my seat, trying to restore blood flow to the areas that need it. Her left eye squints as she watches me. Ryan called me the second they pulled out of his driveway with you in the back seat. When you requested me, I was already here. I was surprised, to say the least. Finally, I ask, do you know what they have on me? Why they think I'm a material witness? Officer Bullock ran your name and Brookwood, Alabama, after he left the Bernards. The warrant popped. He made the call and talked to the officer on Amy Holder's case first thing this morning. They have reason to believe you were at the scene when she died and either have knowledge of what happened in the moments before her death or may have assisted or been a factor in her death. They requested you be brought in, so the local guys headed to Ryan's to pick you up. Evie Porter and Brookwood, Alabama, should not have any connection to Amy Holder in any way. What proof do they have that I was there? I'm told there is a photo of you at the scene. The local police are saying Atlanta PD hasn't shared it with them, so they couldn't show it to me. Not sure if that's the truth or not. Regardless, I have requested a copy of it and have been told it is forthcoming. I nod, taking it all in. How do they know the person in the image is Evie Porter specifically? Rachel's head tilts to the side. I'm not sure what you're asking. And I'm sure she's wondering why I'm referring to myself in third person. Is there a complete record on Evie Porter? Anything other than her presence where Amy Holder died? I ask in a frustrated voice. I'm not ready to tell her everything yet, but I need to know everything she does. I'm not at the point where I can reclaim the Luca Marino identity, and I need to protect it a little longer until I know exactly what's going on. For now, Luca Marino is dead and gone, and I am stuck being Evie Porter. Rachel leans forward and rests her arms on the table. Want to tell me what's going on? I can't help you if you keep me in the dark. I knew Amy Holder. She shows no surprise in this admission. But when I knew her, my name wasn't Evie Porter. Her head cocks to the side. What was it? Regina Hale. Regina Hale, she repeats. I nod and she stares at me. Are you Regina Hale? She asks. I shake my head no. Is Regina Hale a real person you impersonated? She finally asks. No. Are you being vague on purpose? She asks. Because if it's more important to keep your secrets than confide in me, I'll show myself out. God, she's a tough bitch. But a tough bitch is what I need. Regina Hale was the name I used when I lived outside of Atlanta. My understanding is that Amy's death was ruled an accident. Rachel leans back in her chair, her arms crossed in front of her as she openly studies me. Is your real name Evie Porter? She asks. I hesitate long enough that she knows the answer, but she still waits for my response. No. What's your real name? She asks. Not Evie Porter. I answer. I'm not ready to give her everything. Not yet. We watch each other, both of us trying to determine who will break first. Finally, Rachel reaches down and pulls some papers out of her briefcase. This is from my own personal search. I can find out if the police have anything more than this. Even though I knew she would do her own search on me, I'm not prepared for the first item she lays down in front of me. It's a photocopy of a student ID from the University of Alabama, with the name Evelyn Porter, and my picture, dated 7 years ago. What is this? I ask. I recognize the picture. It's from the first job I did, the Kingston job under the name Izzy Williams. But here it is on a school ID for Evelyn Porter. Rachel doesn't say anything, but hands me another piece of paper. It's a photocopy of a driver's license dated 6 years ago. Again, the picture is of me, but the name on the license is Evelyn Porter. This image is one I used for the Andrew Marshall job under the name Mia Bianchi. Another page lands on the table. Evelyn Porter's passport dated 4 years ago. Another picture of me that was intended for a job in Florida under the name Wendy Wallace. Three more pieces of paper, an electricity bill, a speeding ticket, and a statement from a doctor's office. Three more pieces of proof that I'm Evelyn Porter. I've spent 8 years hiding my real identity, while Mr. Smith has spent 8 years creating a new active one for me. Devin and I are so thorough when we research a new town and a new mark, but not doing a deep dive into the name assigned to me was a blind spot. Rachel waits for some sort of reaction from me. When she realizes she's not going to get one, she leans back in her chair and blows out a loud breath. You still want to tell me you aren't Evelyn Porter? I'm back to being still, calm, composed. My brain may be firing in a million different directions, but I refuse to let anyone know that. If you're not Evelyn Porter and you refuse to tell me who you really are, how am I supposed to help you? She asks. I need out of here. I need a few days to get this straightened out. She's already shaking her head. I can try, but don't get your hopes up. They've been looking for you for a while, and they don't want a chance you disappearing on them. All they've got is the formal request to interview you as a potential material witness, not a suspect in her death, so there's that. but I don't see them letting you just waltz right out of here today. I can probably have you out in a day or so, but it will be contingent on you going immediately to Atlanta for questioning. Time is what I need more than anything else right now. I wait a few seconds, weighing my options, then pull her notebook and pen toward me. I scribble a name and push it back. I don't want to say it aloud in case there are still ears listening in. Call this man. Say your client was on Hilton Head in June 2017. Tell him to get me out of here today. Rachel leans forward, her face a shade paler than it was before. You want me to call him and mention Hilton Head, June 2017? Then what? Ask him to pull some strings to get you released? It's not a question, so I don't bother giving her an answer. She gives me a quick nod, then leaves the room. I'm surprised she didn't badger me about the cryptic message, but I'm learning I didn't give Rachel enough credit. I never wanted to be sitting here, facing what I'm facing, but I was prepared for it nonetheless. It's time to call in my favor. The door cracks open slowly, but it's too early for Rachel to be back. I relax into my chair, ready to play the game with the detectives. And then Ryan's head peeks through the open space, like he's not sure he's in the right room. When he thought the police were there for him, he was worried about protecting me. Now he looks at me with apprehension.
Rachel talked the cops into letting me see you for a minute. I think they're all too scared to tell her no. She did say to expect the cameras and mics to be back on, though.
They probably want him in here with me, hoping I'll say something to him they can use against me. He hesitates just a moment. Then he's by my side and pulling me into his arms. I'm surprised by my own flood of emotion. It's a relief to see him. He holds me close, squeezing me tight, as he mumbles quietly,
"What the hell, Evie?"
I should step away, break contact with him. But I can't let him go. I don't want to let him go. I blame my lowered defenses on the long day, the long past several days.
"Are you okay?"
he asks. "Yes," I answer. "Better now that you're here." He pulls back so he can look at me.
"Rachel says she's working on getting you out of here."
"Good. That's good." He looks tired. The past 24 hours haven't been kind to him. First, he loses his childhood friend. Then his girlfriend is hauled off in a police cruiser. He laces his fingers in mine.
"What's going on, Evie? That cop said you're wanted for questioning as a material witness in the death of some woman in Atlanta. They think you were there when it happened."
"Yeah, that's what I was told too. I was as surprised as you were that they wanted to talk to me. I had no idea there was a warrant out for me," I say, making sure I don't say anything that I wouldn't say in front of the cops, since they're probably listening.
"Does that mean they think something is suspicious about her death? I mean, why else would they need a warrant to talk to you?"
I take a deep breath and blow it out. "I have no idea why they think I know anything." He's nodding while I talk, as if he's weighing the truth of my words. Before he can say anything else, Rachel opens the door and slips into the room. Her eyes bounce back and forth between us, the judgment there very clear. I'm lying to her friend.
"Evie," she says, with heavy emphasis on my name.
"I made the call. It seems to have been successful. We'll know for sure soon." I nod, because I knew it would be. She looks at Ryan. "Can you give us a few minutes? I need to go over some things with Evie." He looks between the two of us, I'm sure wondering what we could possibly talk about that he can't hear. When I don't say it's okay for him to stay, he says,
"Of course. I'll be just outside."
And then he's gone. She waves her hand, gesturing at the room. "Mics and cameras are back off." I nod, waiting for whatever she wants to say that no one else can hear. "Are you going to tell him who you really are?" she asks. "I hired you to handle the legal aspects of my life, not the personal ones." She's not deterred. "He's my friend." I don't respond, and we stare at each other a few seconds before she says, "I'll be back as soon as the release comes through. If it comes through." "It will," I say. She throws me a look as she leaves the room. I sit back in the chair and clear my mind so I can start planning. Luca Marino, 6 years ago. I take my time driving from Hilton Head back to Raleigh, North Carolina, with the last 12 hours heavy on my mind. I shouldn't care what Andrew Marshall thinks about me now, but I do. I'm off the grid. Matt has called my phone a million times and texted threat after threat, but I am not fazed. I park in front of AAA bail bonds mid-morning on Monday, almost 48 hours after I left Andrew at that resort in South Carolina, even though I was instructed never to set foot back here. Matt is not expecting me. The last time I was here, I was terrified. I had just fled the Kingston's house after leaving a bleeding Jenny Kingston dying on the floor and a sleeping Miles on the couch. Today is different. Today, I walk into his office like I own it. There are a few random people scattered around the waiting room and the same girl at the front desk. She gives me a half-hearted smile when I walk toward her, but her expression changes quickly when I bypass her desk and head down the hall.
Wait, you need to check in first,
she yells, hot on my heels. I twist open the door to Matt's office, and she stops herself just before colliding with my back.
Where the fuck have you been?
Matt yells the second he sees me. Then he looks at the receptionist behind me.
Get the fuck back out front.
She makes a U-turn just as I shut his office door. I sit in the same chair across from his desk that I did 2 years ago. He looks like he hasn't slept since Friday, since the last time we spoke, since the last time he could see the video feed he had set up, right before I cut it.
My girl looked for Andrew all fucking weekend, even went and knocked on his door, and where did you disappear to? You pulled a fucking Houdini on this job.
His face is red, and bits of spit are flying from his mouth. I take my time answering him. Your plan was stupid. I improved it. He grits his teeth, and his eyes scan me at a frantic pace.
What does that mean?
He finally asks. Get Mr. Smith on the phone, I say. And now he looks like he wants to murder me. Matt comes around to the front of his desk and stands over me. He leans down, putting his hands on the arms of my chair to box me in.
You answer to me,
he says. No, I don't. Not anymore. I raise my arm and look at my watch. You have 5 minutes or I walk, and you don't want me to walk. I'm playing a very dangerous game, but I have to go with my gut. It never lets me down. We stare at each other for a long, tense moment. Something happened to me when I took over that job and made it my own, and I'm not going back to how it was before. 4 minutes. He shoves off my chair so hard that I'm in danger of toppling backward. I kick my feet out to regain my balance. He picks up his phone. Turning his back to me, he talks quietly to Mr. Smith. A few seconds later, he's spinning around with the phone on speaker.
Talk,
Matt says. Silence on the other end, but I don't let that stop me. Andrew Marshall is a bust. He was never going to cheat on his wife. He's too squeaky clean. And if you force something, the shame of it would have made him drop out of the race completely. It doesn't do you any good to have dirt on someone who isn't powerful. 10 minutes with this guy, and you'd have known that. Matt's eyes bore into me while I let Mr. Smith's silence fill the room. But I got you something better. Senator Nelson. He's held his seat in Georgia for 18 years. He's on all the good committees. He loves God, his wife, his country. He also loves to have his ass spanked while wearing a ball gag. He's all yours. Just tell me where to send the flash drive. It's clear I'm cutting Matt out by not giving it to him to pass along. What I don't add is Andrew Marshall is mine now. He will be governor soon, and he realizes just how close he came to being owned, while also understanding who saved him from that. I watch Matt, and Matt watches the phone. There is a film of sweat popping out on his forehead. That conversation with Andrew was hard. When he woke up the next morning, still on the balcony, he had questions, and I answered them all. Vigilant. That's what he has to be going forward, No blind trust, even if that person proves to be trustworthy. That's a hard lesson to learn. He thanked me, then offered to help me in any way he could to leave this life. To live a life filled with honor, not with crime. Because that's who Andrew Marshall is. I hugged him and thanked him and promptly left him. I also know if I ever need him, really need him, he will be there for me. When it doesn't seem like Mr. Smith will be speaking to me today, I continue. You may not like I changed the job, and the results may not be the ones you were hoping for, but Matt's plan would have failed. And Senator Nelson is better than a failed plan and wasted resources. If you would like to continue to engage my services, I deal directly with you, not Matt. I'm good at what I do, better than him. And you know it. Silence. Matt is furious. A deep red flush is creeping up his neck, and his jaw is clenched tight. Finally, Mr. Smith speaks.
Matt, give Luca your phone, then go wait in the hall. Luca, once he's gone, shut the door and take me off speaker.
Matt's eyes look like they will bulge right out of his head. He leaves the office, slamming the door behind him. I pick up the phone and hit the button to make the call private. I'm here, I say.
I was told there was quite an event in Andrew Marshall's suite on Friday night.
I don't hesitate. Yes. I invited some big hitters up for a cocktail party once I realized what Matt had planned. I knew if I couldn't get the dirt on Andrew, I better get it on someone else equally or more important. Silence. And then, finally, more questions.
Where was Andrew Marshall during this party? If you have what you say you have, was he a witness to the senator's behavior?
I knocked Andrew out and put him on the lounger on the balcony. Senator Nelson took one of the girls back to his room, and that's where the event between them took place. Silence again. The wait between his questions and my answers is unnerving, which I'm sure is the point.
Matt's instructions were delivered to you at 4:30 in the afternoon, and you sent out invites for the cocktail gathering in Marshall's room at 5:45. How were you able to find the tech and personnel to pull this off in such a short amount of time? Or were you already planning to go rogue before you were given your instructions?
Assuming he was going to just take what I was giving him was naive. As you've said before, I am resourceful and think on my feet. This is just another example of that. I did not go into the weekend believing I would have to alter the plan, but it would have been unprofessional not to have been prepared for any eventuality. It was clear when I got the instructions that Matt had taken the lead on this job. It was sloppy and amateurish.
And I'm to believe you walked away from the weekend with absolutely nothing on Marshall? That you, in fact, have not uncovered a single thing in all the time you've been with him that can be used as leverage against him?
That is the truth. He's as squeaky as they come. I can tell he doesn't believe me. After a minute, I check the phone to see if we're still connected.
While Senator Nelson will be helpful, he wasn't who we sent you after. But I can acknowledge and appreciate salvaging a job, he says. Moving forward, you'll answer directly to me. We'll see how that works for us. For now, you are quite the surprise. Let's just see if it is a good one or a bad one.
I ignore the ominousness of that last part. My pay will reflect my new position, correct? I don't expect the chuckle.
You don't mind pushing me, do you?
Would you respect me if I didn't? He ignores my question.
Let's see if you're as good as you think you are. There is a situation in Florida you could help with. A sleepy little college town with lots of money. I need you to go there.
No problem, I say without hesitation. Even though I don't know what the job is, I know this is my one shot to prove I deserve leveling up.
Go to the Holiday Inn Express near the airport. Check in under your current alias and wait for further instructions.
And then the line goes dead.
I'm finished talking to him,
I yell at the closed door. And Matt is pushing it open seconds later, jerking his phone from my hand.
You're going to regret this, he says.
I shrug, then take the tiny paper swan out of my pocket, dropping it on the corner of his desk.
What the fuck is that?
Something to remember me by, I say as I head to the door. At the same moment I'm walking out of this building, there are small white boxes being delivered to multiple locations. In each box is an origami swan, similar to what I just gave Matt. When the swan is pulled open, there's a picture showing the recipient in a very compromising position, with the words, Hilton Head 2017, written underneath it in red Sharpie. And that's it. I just made my team a little bit bigger, even if the members aren't there by choice. A favor was called in that night I was almost arrested in Raleigh, and that was all it took to get me out of trouble. There will be a time when I need these men, and they will come running. I now have a handful of well-respected, God-fearing politicians in my back pocket. A senator, a couple of congressmen, several mayors and state legislators, and poor Judge McIntyre from Louisiana, who tagged along to the cocktail party with a friend. Chapter 17. Present Day. Judge McIntyre came through like a champ, just like I knew he would. I'm riding with Ryan back to the house as Rachel follows behind us in her car. She agreed to be held accountable for my actions, so it looks like I'm stuck with her. In order to walk out of there today, I had to agree to meet with the detectives in Atlanta on Friday morning to answer questions on the circumstances surrounding the death of Amy Holder. If I refused to agree to do that, I would be held at the Lake Forbing Police Department until the escort sent by the Atlanta Police Department arrived and dragged me back there. If I'm not there for that meeting on Friday morning, there will be another warrant issued for my arrest for failure to show. Yesterday, Mr. Smith's plan was unclear, but that is not the case anymore. While I thought I could always go back to being Luca Marino, after today, it will be next to impossible to lose the Evie Porter identity. As a condition of being released, I was photographed and fingerprinted. So now not only am I in the system for the first time ever, I'm in the system as Evelyn Porter. I was so careful to keep Luca Marino clean and off the grid, a blank slate that I could shape when I was ready, that I've got nothing to prove I'm actually her. But Evie Porter has a full background and history, including pictures, the freshly uploaded fingerprints, and the material witness warrant for questioning in the death of Amy Holder. 8 years ago, Mr. Smith saved me from potential arrest, and now he's set me up for one. Today is Monday, and already half gone, so I have only 3 full days to handle this. It's quiet in the car. Of all the questions twisting and turning in my head right now, the one that plagues me the most is, why would Mr. Smith up the stakes on this job? I may be stuck in this town and in this identity for now, but my work here is done. Was this ever a real job or just a ruse to keep me in one place? You can ask me anything, I finally say when the silence becomes too much.
How did she die?
He asks.
The woman they want to question you about.
She died in a fire. He cringes slightly, eyes still firmly on the road.
How did you know her?
Through work, I answer, which is true. She was my last job. We're a few minutes from his house, and he hasn't asked me anything else. So I push him. You're not going to ask me if I was there, if I know anything about what happened to her, if I played a part in it?
No. And it's not because I don't want the answers.
He turns and looks at me a second or so before his focus is back on the road.
It's because you're not ready to tell me the truth, and I'd rather you not lie to me.
You're not scared you're shacking up with a criminal? I ask, no hint of amusement in my voice. Not afraid I'll set fire to that big, beautiful house of yours? Push, push, push. His humorless laugh fills the interior of the car.
My entire street witnessed my girlfriend being taken away by the cops. I've spent the whole day at the police station doing whatever I could to secure her release. And now she's picking a fight with me as I drive us home because I refuse to play games with her.
He glances my way again.
Am I happy this is happening? No. Am I here supporting you through it? Yes. Am I scared of you? No. I'm patient enough to wait until you're ready to talk to me about this. But I'm not having hypothetical conversations with you about it.
His words hit me in a way I didn't expect. Ryan reaches over and slides his hand into mine, softening the vibe in the car.
We'll go to Atlanta and tell them you don't know anything, answer their questions, and then we can get back to normal.
He says it so decisively that I almost believe that is an option for me. I have no idea what normal would even look like. We pull into the garage, but Ryan keeps the engine running.
I need to stop by my office to pick up a few things, since I wasn't able to get by there earlier, he says,
staring through the front windshield. I get out of the car before I say something I will regret. That little speech was making me want to tell him all the things I shouldn't, and now he's running from me. I'm almost in the house when I hear Rachel shut her car door, her heels clicking on the concrete behind me.
Evie, we need to go over some things,
she says as she follows me in the back door. I nod, but don't turn back to face her.
I need a shower first,
and a little time.
Give me an hour.
I'm heading up the stairs before she has a chance to say anything else. I stop cold in front of our closed bedroom door. We never shut this door when the room is empty. I think back to this morning when we were getting ready for the day, each of us moving at a snail's pace, groggy from the weekend. I went down first, then Ryan joined me not long after. But then I ran back up here to get my phone from where it was charging beside the bed. The door was open when I left the room. I twist the knob slowly, then give it a push. The bed is made, which is another thing we rarely do, and certainly wouldn't have done it this morning given the state we were in. I scan the room, then suck in a breath when I see what's waiting for me on the nightstand on my side of the bed. An origami swan. It's set back against the lamp and small enough not to raise the interest of anyone but me. I stare at it longer than I should, giving it power it doesn't deserve. Finally, I reach for it and pull it open. There's another piece of paper inside the body of the swan. There are two pictures printed on one side. This is what the cops in Atlanta have on me, compliments of Mr. Smith, I'm sure. And he delivered it to me in the same way I let Judge McIntyre know what I have on him. In the top image, I'm standing outside a hotel in downtown Atlanta. And Amy Holder is only a few feet away, her face angry and her hands raised as she flips me her middle finger. In the second image, I'm following Amy inside the hotel. The same hotel where only a few minutes later, every cell phone camera on the street out front caught the black plumes of smoke that poured out her balcony window. It is clear there was a problem between us, and it's also clear I went into the hotel after her. I remember this moment perfectly. Her heated words, the stares from anyone close enough to hear what she was screaming at me. And then later, the sounds of the fire truck sirens blasting through the air, the people screaming, the acrid smell of smoke. The perfect piece of evidence, placing me at the scene in a confrontational moment with the dead woman. Knowing Mr. Smith, there are other shots from other angles that are just as damning, and that can be passed along to the Atlanta PD whenever he's ready. This is just a teaser to whet their appetite. The backside of the paper lets me know what he wants from me. It's a picture of me taken on the same day, but the location is different. I'm leaving a bank a few blocks away from the hotel Amy was staying in. At the bottom of the paper is a phone number. Retrieving myself from my bag, I call him immediately.
I didn't expect to hear from you so soon. You managed to get out of there quicker than I gave you credit for,
Mr. Smith says when I answer, the robotic pitch a bit higher than usual.
You've always underestimated me. It takes everything in me to inject a touch of playfulness into my voice.
You will turn over what you retrieved from Amy Holder in Atlanta, or you will discover this isn't going to end pleasantly for you.
I squeeze my eyes shut and take a silent deep breath. I explained what happened there.
I didn't get it.
It's gone. Burned up in the fire.
Then what is in the safe deposit box?
I look back at the picture of me on the front steps of the bank. Please tell me you didn't set me up with the cops because of this picture.
And you are now underestimating me, he sneers.
I have the video surveillance from the security cameras inside the Wells Fargo branch on Peachtree Street. You rented the box before the fire department had fully doused the flames engulfing Amy Holder's body. You never keep anything important on you. And this would have been the quickest and closest place to safely stash what you retrieved. The only reason we're even having this conversation is because I don't know the box number, nor do I have the signature card details.
It's not what you think, I say. It has nothing to do with Amy or her death.
The mechanical growl due to the voice changer makes me cringe.
Now is not the time to play dumb with me. You will go back to Atlanta, but I want you there on Wednesday. There is a room reserved for you at the Candler Hotel in downtown Atlanta. You will be met in the lobby on Thursday morning at 10 a.m. by one of my representatives, and he will accompany you to the bank and inside the vault. He will remove the contents of the safe deposit box himself. If what you say is true, and the contents have nothing to do with the Amy Holder job, then we will put this matter to bed once and for all, and continue forward as we have. And you will find the detectives in Atlanta will quickly lose interest in you.
And I'm supposed to believe you'll call off the dogs if I show you the contents of the safe deposit box? And what about this job? I'm just walking away from it? For someone who hates failure, why is it okay for this job?
With the shit you're in with me, that's what you want to know? The only thing that matters is getting back what Amy Holder took. All of it.
He's quiet a moment, and then adds,
At one time, you were my best asset. And now, look how far you've fallen.
I'm still your best asset, and we both know it.
The loud bark of laughter startles me.
You walked right in and talked to the cops. There's a file with your name on it now. Did you even put up a fight when they asked for your fingerprints? There's video of you from that interrogation room. Your composure must be commended.
His words are like bullets, each one hitting the target.
How many Judge McIntyres do you have hidden in your pocket?
I let out a laugh that I hope doesn't sound forced. Enough that I can keep dodging the curveballs you're throwing at me.
Unfortunately, Luca, you made your choice, so now I'm making mine.
He growls. Don't act like you haven't been setting me up since the beginning. All these years, I've been one of your best, yet you've just been waiting around for the moment to turn on me. He makes a tisking sound.
Of course I have. Do you think I wouldn't have a contingency plan in place if one of mine gets out of hand? Don't get sentimental now. This is business.
Did the woman pretending to be me know what was going to happen to her when she took the job? Did you tell her it was a death sentence?
That woman was an unfortunate casualty. She had potential. But I'm always prepared to make the hard decisions. The Holder job is more important.
And there it is. Confirmation that their deaths weren't an accident. Did she even finish the job you sent her on? Or did she let you down in some way?
She was sent to unnerve you. And she did. She was sent to make a name for herself as Luca Marino. And she did. She was sent to dinner that night to make sure you were the last person to see her alive, so the police would have no choice but to question your evening together. I thought I'd have to step in to make sure they became aware of the warrant out for you, but you made that easy on me too. Her snooping through your stuff was to get under your skin, because I knew how much you'd hate that. The spreadsheet you left for her to find gave me a little laugh, though. Nicely played.
The urge to scream at him and throw this phone until it breaks into a million pieces rolls through me. But I can't show him how gutted I feel. What guarantees do I have that I won't end up like her? She came in here to do a job, and what thanks does she get? A nosedive off a bridge.
I can guarantee you will meet the same fate if you fail to deliver what I send you for a second time.
His tone softens when he adds,
I know you'll do whatever is necessary to get that fairy tale ending you've always wanted. Big house and garden you and Mama planned all those years ago while she was wasting away in that single wide. You can still have all that. I can make Evie Porter a distant memory and bring Luca Marino back from the dead if you give me what I want.
Does he honestly think I would believe that's a possible outcome? I don't know how many times I have to tell you. Atlanta was a bust. Whatever you wanted from Amy Holder, she took with her to the grave.
That safe deposit box does not hold what you think it does. He waits a beat, then says,
This number will be disconnected the second this call ends. You know how it works. If you don't meet my associate in the hotel lobby at the designated time, I'll be forced to give the Atlanta PD everything I have. Those pictures are just a preview of the main show. You can still run, but you're not a ghost anymore.
He adds one last thing before ending the call.
And the cops won't be the only ones hunting you down.
And then the line goes dead. I don't try to call back, because he doesn't make empty threats. I take the paper he left me to the bathroom, drop it in the sink, then pull out the lighter I keep for the candles next to the tub. It only takes a few minutes for it to turn to ash. I wash away all traces of it before the smoke sets off any alarms. Turning the shower on as hot as I can stand, I undress and step under the spray, desperately needing to wash the last several hours away. There are a lot of questions that need answers. There are a lot of emotions I need to sift through. The anger that the man I worked for all these years has turned against me in a way I could never imagine. The disappointment that washed over me upon hearing he built an identity for me from the beginning for the sole purpose of tearing me down. The bitterness that filled me when I discovered he was planning for my demise from the very first job. It all hits harder than I thought it would, harder than I was prepared for. But the part that's hitting me the hardest is the death of the woman. She came in and did her job. It's my fault she's dead, that James is dead. If I wasn't playing this game with Mr. Smith, she'd still be alive. I scrub every inch of my body, shampoo my hair, wash my face. Anything to feel clean. Her death sits heavy on my shoulders. It fills my lungs. It clouds my vision. The bathroom door squeaks open, making me jump, even though I expect Ryan to come in to check on me once he gets back from his office. Steam has fogged the glass, so I can't make out his details until he opens the door. A line appears in the middle of his forehead as he stares at me. His expression is one I can't read. Just when I think he'll walk away, he quietly undresses and joins me. He takes the washcloth from me before turning me toward the shower wall. One hand lands on my hip, holding me in place, while the other runs the cloth in long, sweeping passes across my back and shoulders. I turn back around and bury my face in his chest while the water rains down around us. And I cry. Once I start, I can't stop. Big, broken sobs that wreck me. Ryan whispers in my ear. Nonsense. Sweet words. Promises. His soft voice finding the chinks in my armor. 10 minutes to fall apart. 10 minutes to soak in the comfort he offers, regardless of whether I deserve it. I will take these 10 minutes, then pull myself back together. The water starts to cool, so Ryan shuts it off, then somehow grabs my towel without letting me go. I stand still as he dries me off.
Want to crawl in the bed? Or want to eat first?
He asks as I pull on a pair of leggings and an oversized tee. Is Rachel still here? I ask. He nods as he towels off.
Yes. She feels personally responsible for you. She plans to stay within arm's reach until we get to Atlanta.
I take in a deep breath, then one more. You don't need to go with me to Atlanta. Ryan shrugs.
Of course I do. But we're not talking about that tonight. We'll make our plans tomorrow.
My mind is already working through different scenarios now that I know what I'm up against. I'll go to Atlanta after I make a few other stops first.
What's going on in that head of yours? He asks.
I don't like that he can read me so well. It shows how much I've let my guard down where he's concerned. Just thinking about what they'll ask me, and what they'll do if I can't answer their questions. Ryan pulls me in close.
I'll be there with you the entire time. So will Rachel. We're on your side. If there's one thing you believe, believe that.
I grasp his hands in mine and pull them to my mouth, kissing each knuckle. I'm hungry, but I need a minute to gather myself. He smiles and squeezes my hands.
I'll go pick up some food. Come down when you're ready.
Ryan leaves the room, and I sink down on our bed. I've had my pity party. And now it's time to get to work.
Chapter 18. Present day. Mr. Smith wants me in Atlanta by the day after tomorrow, and the last thing I need is to have Rachel there with me. I head downstairs to find she has set up a mini office in the dining room. Her laptop sits on one end, while file boxes are scattered down the length of the table. "Where's Ryan?" I ask in place of a greeting. She doesn't look up as she organizes a set of files next to her computer. "He ran to pick up food." I watch her long enough to unnerve her. She stops what she's doing and finally gives me her full attention, dropping down in the chair at the end of the table. "We have to be in Atlanta by 9 a.m. Friday, so we need to leave here on Thursday," she says. "I've looked at flights, and there's a direct one at 4:30 that afternoon. We can get a couple of rooms in one of those hotels near the airport. Let's plan to spend today and tomorrow going over everything so we're prepared." I sit in the chair next to her, pushing the papers out of my way so I can lean on the table. "I'll meet you in Atlanta by 8:30 on Friday morning, but there are some things I need to do first. Alone." She's shaking her head before I finish my sentence. "I'm responsible for you. If you don't show, it's my ass. And while I'm sure you can easily and happily disappear, I live here. My whole life is here." "I wouldn't do that to Ryan," I answer quietly. She rolls her eyes. "He doesn't even know your real name." Rachel wants to get a rise out of me, and she's pretty close to succeeding. "It's not up for discussion. I could ditch you anytime I want, and you'd never see it coming. But I'm being nice by telling you I will meet you in Atlanta on Friday. Just tell me where to be." We're staring at each other, waiting for the other to break. The back door opening alerts us to Ryan's arrival with the food, and I need this settled before he's in the middle of it. "I know it may not mean much to you, but I give you my word. I will be there. And when I give my word, I don't break it, ever." She lets out a rugged breath. "You don't think we need to spend any time going over your case?" "I do need to prepare, but it needs to be with Devin, not Rachel." "I do not." Ryan peeks his head into the dining room. His gaze darts from me to Rachel and back again.
"All good in here?"
he asks.
"All good," Rachel says.
"Of course," I answer.
"Y'all come eat," he says.
And we follow him back into the kitchen. I pull out plates and utensils while Ryan sets the food out buffet style on the island.
"I got a few different things because I didn't know what everyone wanted."
In the song and dance of getting the meal ready to eat, Rachel watches Ryan and me closely, watches how we move around the room, how we are always conscious of where the other one is. She is wary of me, and I'm sure it's hard for her to witness, knowing what she does. I'm scooping a huge serving of chicken parm on my plate when I finally remember Ryan was supposed to have gone to the Bernard's house today.
"Was Mrs. Bernard upset you weren't there today?"
He takes a long pull from his beer before he answers me.
"I called her and told her I had something come up and wouldn't be able to make it."
I take the seat next to him at the kitchen table. "His funeral will be this week, so I think you should definitely be here for that instead of going with me to Atlanta."
"I already told the Bernards I won't be there because I've got an out-of-town emergency."
I'm shaking my head. "You really need to be there. Rachel and I can handle things in Atlanta." He drops his fork on his plate, and the sound echoes through the kitchen.
"Pretty sure I can decide where I need to be."
We're giving Rachel a good show, so I decide to table this conversation until we're in the privacy of our bedroom. She already knows I plan to leave this house alone. I look up at her and say, "I assume you're okay missing the funeral as well?"
"Yep,"
she says, making that P really pop.
"Last time I talked to James was about 2 years ago, when he called begging for money. I gave it to him on the condition he would get some help. I even had a spot lined up for him in a rehab facility. He ghosted me as soon as he got the cash. I was one of the few from our group who didn't see him when he got to town a couple of weeks ago."
Ryan grunts.
"Yeah, I have about 10 stories like that."
The rest of the meal is filled with meaningless chit-chat, and soon enough we retreat to our bedroom and Rachel to the spare downstairs. Standing in the middle of our room, I blow out a long, slow breath, center myself. "I need to take care of a few things alone," I say to Ryan as he turns down our bed. not noticing that someone made it up for us. His expression sharpens, but I push on. I'm meeting Rachel in Atlanta. You're welcome to meet me there, too. Ryan watches me as he strips down and climbs into bed.
I don't want to talk anymore today.
He holds the covers back, inviting me to slip in the bed with him. I should push, but I'm done with talking, too. So I kill the lights and join him. I'm at the kitchen table, my notebook out in front of me, when Rachel wanders in. I pull out the two sheets I was writing on, fold them until they are small enough to fit in the back pocket of my jeans, then put the notebook in my backpack before moving to the coffee pot so I can fill my travel mug.
Where are the cups? Rachel asks.
I nod toward the cabinet over the pot. She ambles over to grab one.
Are you leaving this morning?
Glancing at the clock, I answer, within the hour. I scroll through Instagram on my phone and stop when I get to the latest post from Food Network that shows Bobby Flay in front of a grill with his trademark shit-eating grin. I comment, Beat Bobby Flay is my number one fave show. 45 minutes to beat him is impossible. Hashtag every good recipe is written down. Normally, I would give Devin more than 45 minutes to meet me at the first spot on the predetermined list. But after yesterday, I'm sure he's refreshing his feed every few minutes like I am. And the hashtag won't make sense to anyone but Devin. But I need him to know I have something to give him so he can tell me where to leave it. Rachel adds a packet of sugar and some creamer to her coffee, then turns to me while she stirs it in.
Does Ryan know?
He does, I say as I continue to scroll, refreshing my own feed. It only takes a couple of minutes for him to post a comment on Spotify's latest post. See You Soon by Coldplay is underrated. Hashtag Twinkies are too. Guess I'm looking for the Twinkies when I get to the meeting spot. I close out of the app, then book it upstairs to pack. I throw some clothes in a bag and move to the bathroom to gather my toiletries. When I come back into the bedroom, Ryan has his own bag sitting on the bed, open and half full.
Do you think I'll need a suit?
He asks. I dump the stuff in my arms into my bag before moving to the closet for my shoes. I need to do this alone. I can't look at him.
I understand you think you need to do this alone, but you're not alone anymore.
His gaze catches mine from across the bed.
I'm coming with you.
I match his stare. But you would miss work on Thursday, and I know how important the appointments on Thursday are for you. I'm pushing right now to see what I can shake loose. His head tilts to the side, his eyes narrowing.
I'm willing to tell you my secrets if you're willing to tell me yours.
His voice is deep and a bit unsettling.
You go first.
There's a glimpse of the guy who ruled that warehouse yard. I just cross my arms and look at him. Ryan throws his hands in the air when I don't take him up on his offer.
I'm not asking any questions. I don't scare easily, and I really don't want you doing whatever it is you think you need to do alone.
We continue to stare at one another until he finally adds,
Plus, my skill set may come in handy in a pinch.
And there's that smile, the one that makes him utterly charming. And as much as I thought smiling was impossible right now, I give him one right back. And what skill set is that? He shrugs and continues packing.
Take me along and find out.
I'm torn on what to do about Ryan. Mr. Smith decided this was the job to put me in while we played this macabre game, and I need to know why. Mr. Smith will expect me to go alone. Until this point, I wanted to be 100% predictable, and now I need to be the exact opposite. Plus, Ryan's arguing pretty hard to come along, even though he'll miss James's funeral and a week of work. Very curious. Forcing out a deep breath, I make a show of giving in. I make all the decisions. If I need to slip off to handle something by myself, there is no argument from you. Not a single word. He nods.
Don't even think about ditching me along the way, he says with a smirk. I can see it all over your face.
We both know that option is always on the table. Rachel is pissed Ryan is going with me, but she isn't. I load our bags into the back of my 4Runner. While closer to the house, Ryan is squaring off with Rachel in a heated conversation. I shut the back hatch and turn toward the street, committing it to memory. I will miss it more than I want to admit. Slipping into the driver's seat, I wait for Ryan. When he hears the engine turn over, he looks at me over his shoulder. Rachel reaches for him when he moves toward the car. She knows things about me that he does not, things she can't tell him since I'm protected by client-attorney privilege, and she's frantic to stop him from coming with me. He's not having it. Ryan slips into the passenger seat, then rolls down the window as Rachel approaches his side. He wanted us to take his Tahoe, but this is my show, and if I decide to leave him somewhere along the way, I'm going to need my own car. Rachel gives me a look I don't particularly like, then focuses on him. I'm not joking, Ryan. No later than 8:30 on Friday morning in Atlanta. I'm working on the detectives meeting us in a location other than the precinct, so as soon as that is finalized, I'll let you know where.
You've mentioned all of this a number of times, he answers.
His head drops back against the headrest, his gaze fixed on the windshield. Her hands grip the open window as if she's physically trying to stop us from driving away. I fidget around in my seat, ready to go. I don't do goodbyes, at all. Ryan must feel my unease because he gives me a nod and I put the car in reverse, letting off the brake enough that Rachel has to pull her hands free and take a step back.
I'll call you,
he says to her as we start inching backward.
And don't be surprised if you have to pick me up after she's abandoned me somewhere.
She clearly doesn't think his joke is funny. Once the window is rolled up and we're on the street in front of his house, he asks,
Do you need me to book a hotel in Atlanta? I mean, I assume that's where we're heading.
I've got it handled, I answer. I pull out of the neighborhood onto one of the busy streets that runs through town, then turn into a gas station. Can you fill us up while I go in for a few snacks for the road? He's out of the car before I finish the question.
Get me a Coke and some chips, barbecue flavor,
he says, just before I step inside the store. I walk down the snack aisle, grabbing a couple of different bags of chips and a package of peanut butter M&Ms. And I spot Devin filling up a cup at the fountain machine. I pull the folded up paper from my back pocket and slide it under the Twinkies. While I'm checking out at the register, he has moved to the snack aisle to retrieve the handwritten letter that will catch him up on what happened yesterday and give the details of the plan I came up with. It's not the best form of communication, but it's old school enough that I know it can't be hacked. If everything goes the way it should, I will see him in person soon. When I get back to the car, I slide into the passenger seat. Ryan looks at me through the open driver's side window, where he's still pumping gas.
I'm guessing you want me to drive now.
Yes, please, I answer, before taking a swig of my Diet Dr. Pepper.
You'll have to tell me where we're going if I'm driving,
he says once he's back in the car. Get on the interstate and head east. We drive for a while without a word between us. The car is quiet. No music playing, no conversation. Only directions when needed. The land flattens out as we head into the Mississippi Delta, where there's nothing but row crops for miles and miles. We're off the main interstate now, bumping along the back roads through the small towns that pop up every hour or so. The kind of towns where the speed limit drops from 55 to 35 with little warning, so the driver isn't prepared for the speed traps that generate the revenue that supports them. We stop for gas again, and Ryan insists on paying for it. I insist he do it with cash. He pulls out a bulging wallet filled with 20s, as if he is more prepared for this trip than I gave him credit for. And I remind myself that he's as shady as I am. I'm sorry you'll miss James's funeral, I say once we're back on the road. He lets out a deep sigh.
Me too.
I don't think he's going to say anything else until he adds,
I spent years helping James, saving James. I gave him money, clothes, a place to stay, put him in rehab more than once. I was a crutch for him. He knew I'd be there. He knew I'd save him. So why bother getting your shit together if there's always someone saving you?
A few minutes pass before I say, I don't need saving. His head jerks in my direction. He looks at me while I stare straight ahead. Then his attention focuses back on the road.
I know that. There are things you may need, but saving isn't one of them.
This makes me want to ask questions, so many questions. But he made it clear. He'd show me his, but I'd have to show mine first. So instead of questions, I say, In 2 miles, you need to take a left.